Hi, this is Eugene Napic in Toronto for the agency.
Hi, this is Candy Minx in Albuquerque, New Mexico for the agency.
Albuquerque, hey. New Mexico. Tell us about Albuquerque.
I will. I just want to say it's great to hear your voice and, you know, catch up with you. Albuquerque is doing great. We did have some pretty cold weather at first, but just today, Steg and I were out for a few hours enjoying the downtown area, taking pictures of murals all over the city. And then we put up a bunch of flyers for the agency as best as we could. And we're just having a fantastic time. Right now, I'm sitting in the amazing Hotel Andalus. It's downtown Albuquerque. It's a boutique hotel, and they've got this library here with a closed door. However, for the last 2 days, they've been playing the music pretty loud. We've recorded here twice already, you and I, for some interviews, but right now I'm by myself and the music's kind of loud, but I hope our audience will understand. I've got a pretty loud voice. I'm sitting on the floor of this library with bare feet and my comfy pants on with my head right by the phone.
Well, you're coming across loud and clear. I can hear a little bit of music, and that just adds to the ambience, I think.
There you go. And I mean, the hotel's paid for the music, right? So we should be okay.
Yeah, I think so. Hopefully no one will sue us for the background music.
Exactly. Thank you. Hey, we're plugging the Hotel Andalus, so that should help too.
Yeah.
What's new with you? How was your trip back from Hanoi?
Well, it's long. It's a long trip back, any which way you look at it. It's 3 hours from Hanoi to Taipei, then a 3-hour layover, then about 13 or 14 hours from Taipei to Toronto. So you're going through a number of time zones, and it's like being in a strange kind of limbo. As well, towards the end of the trip, there's, I would say, increased nervousness throughout Asia about the novel coronavirus.
Oh, dear.
The COVID-19, I think they're calling it now. And so by the time I got to the airport in Taipei, I would say 95% of people were wearing masks.
Oh dear.
Yeah, I mean, just because they're scared, you know, everyone's scared of this thing. And it's now since there's been a bit of an outbreak in South Korea, a number of people, and in Italy as well. So I was okay in Hanoi. There wasn't any outbreak there, which was good. I was able to enjoy the my time there and enjoy the city and the people. Yeah. But, you know, there, people were concerned about it. When I talked to folks at the Go Club, they said that that they were quite concerned.
I really want to ask you how your next Go game went. That was the Tuesday. I didn't talk to you about that since you returned, because that was the Tuesday and I was already on the highway coming to Albuquerque.
Well, I went back to the Go Club and I played two games. The first against a 3-dan opponent I had played before. And he once again ate me for breakfast. I made a couple really boneheaded moves, I think because I was nervous. But mostly when we reviewed the game, he said that I had to work on faster development, that I was just developing a little bit too slow, and he was able to gain an advantage. So it was a really good lesson that he gave me.
Oh, yeah.
And then in the second game, I played an opponent who was weaker than I am, and I gave him a 3-stone handicap, and he played quite well locally, but he had difficulty with the global aspect of the game. In other words, I was able to dictate direction enough that I was able to grab a very large area in the bottom of the board, and he couldn't recover from that. There was just not enough territory left on the board. So I was able to win that game fairly easily.
Okay. Wow. Interesting. That's great. What a great addition to your travels to be able to do something so homey and challenging and familiar at the same time.
Yeah, it was really interesting to play with players on the other side of the world. It was pretty exciting.
Yeah. And I think also it touches me in that kind of universality that sometimes our obsessions and habits or hobbies or passions, we find someone else somewhere in the world that has them. And it, you don't need to speak the same language.
Well, that's very true. And one thing that's really clear visiting a place like Hanoi, in which the culture is, it's significantly different than our North American culture in many respects. But push comes to shove, we're all the same. You know, we all have the same, same issues, the same feelings. And I was able to get along with people very, very well, regardless of how much language that we shared. You know, sometimes I was able to have a great time with people that I could communicate with, but without a lot of words, because I wouldn't have Vietnamese and they wouldn't have much English in some cases. So that was really interesting to see just how easy it is to get on with people when you have a language barrier.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Well, we don't have a language barrier here in our trip. And we've been to Albuquerque many times. Maybe this is our fifth year. And we've got a familiarity. We always like to go check out what coffee shops still are there that we know, what restaurants are there. We have eaten like kings, some of which I'll probably tell you about next time we record. But I've been taking notes of the food because you shared all your food with me. I was trying to be more in tune with things. And we've just had a lovely time. The conference was fantastic. Another amazing experience. I feel like a very, very lucky person, able to add this kind of depth and interest, a hobby deeper into my life, and to meet so many different people that are as crazy obsessed as I am.
And, for our listeners, Candy, who maybe haven't heard the previous episodes, can you just tell them what the conference is, what it's all about, and what your involvement is?
Thank you. It's the Southwest Conference for American Popular Culture. I hope I've said their name correctly. It took me a long time to get the hashtag. Hashtag SWPACA 2020. And my dyslexia, I had to really concentrate on that one. So I was presenting a paper on a panel on the Cormac McCarthy session. Now, this conference has, you know, dozens of different panels and sessions, sometimes on zombie TV, sometimes on esoterica, sometimes on Hitchcock, sometimes on food. You get a really great wide variety of topics in pop culture. And it's predominantly academics presenting their paper. And then we do all kinds of fun things at nighttime after the sessions. We go for dinner or walk around and, you know, go for a lot of drinks and wine and, you know, chit-chat and arguing. It's a lot of fun. I wanted to tell you about a couple of the panels.
Yes, please do.
One was very interesting. I try to get to the Hitchcock panels. I think I got to two this week. And one had a fellow called Professor Kent Drummond. He teaches at the English department in the University of Wyoming. And he talked on the Hitchcock panel about the walking tour in San Francisco for Vertigo. So it's a tourist-based activity. He has published a book called The Road to Wicked, and that is about the history of The Wizard of Oz. So I thought, well, I'm going to try and get that book because I love The Wizard of Oz. And one of the things he stood up during his talk, and he didn't really do a paper. He gave us a handout, and he had a different style of doing a presentation that was somewhat involving us, which was really nice. And he talked about his book, which Frank Baum, who wrote The Wizard of Oz, it was a 70-page story 120 years ago, and its resonance has gone all the way to Broadway with the musical Wicked. I've never seen Wicked, and I didn't really ever want to. I started to read the novel when it first came out, and I was pretty excited, but I didn't feel like having a revisionist of Wizard of Oz because I love Wizard of Oz as is.
Yeah, I understand completely.
Yeah, so I never wanted to read about the witches. I understand they give them a lot of life and background, and I'm sure it's really amazing. I'm just curmudgeonly about it. I'm really got a fetish about The Wizard of Oz. And I've read about the history of the filming. Oh, the music's going crazy in here now. I don't know if you can hear that.
Yes, I can hear it swirling around.
It's somewhat distracting. It was easy jazz at some point. Now, I don't know what that was. And so he talked a bit about that, which was pretty interesting. And then he talked about this walking tour in San Francisco. It really had me intrigued. And he gave us a handout that said, number one, what does the Hitchcock tour consist of? Number two, who leads the tour and what do they talk about? Three, who goes on this tour and why? Four, who gets out of going on the tour? Who gets what going out of the tour? Gee, I have a trouble reading that sentence. And then what is this tour really about? So that's how he broke down his presentation, which was really helpful to see that all laid out ahead and go through it. And basically, he said that the walking tour creates experientially sustainability for the movie and San Francisco and this tour. He said a lot of young couples go on this tour, which of course a few of us in the audience laughed because I'm not seeing that as very romantic personally. I love the movie Vertigo, but I don't consider it a romantic accomplishment. And maybe it's going to show that these couples are going to have very well-adjusted relationships.
Or not.
I was really surprised to hear that. And he said it was young, so I was happy to hear that young people are returning to Vertigo and still checking it out. And he said that he took the tour, if I understood him correctly, three times. Two gentlemen led him on these other tours, and then one woman. And the woman was very interesting. He said that she had a lot more background information or came at it from a different perspective. I love the idea of them going to the bridge and to, you know, the tree with the big, all the circles where the forest where they count the tree circles. I mean, I think if I went to San Francisco now, I would want to do that tour. I've been to San Fran before, but I did more of the beatnik thing. I was really into that kind of aspect of San Francisco at the time. And I think I would like to do the Vertigo walking tour. And she told the story of how Kim Novak, being only 24 years old, she would be flying off to Vegas every weekend because she was having a relationship with Sammy Davis Jr.
Wow.
Right? So I was like, oh my God, that's fascinating. And Hitchcock was completely incensed because she would just take off and she wasn't under his, you know, watchful eye, or she was threatening the production company because she'd be flying to Las Vegas every weekend. And I'm sure she was partying like crazy. I'm just assuming, that's not fair of me, but I'm assuming, or just, you know, making love all weekend. I don't know. Which also reminds me that, I haven't watched it yet. I recorded it, but there's American Masters has a special on Sammy Davis Jr. last week and this week on Miles Davis. So I'm looking forward to those things, but I've recorded them back home. But I thought, I wonder if they're going to mention Kim Novak in that PBS documentary. So this was a fantastic panel. It was really good. I had already, I think I texted you about the other movie that blew my mind. I have watched Rear Window so many times. And part of my argument with Cormac McCarthy and in art and literature is that there is a star lore involved in this form of literature, in a certain tradition in arts and literature, with the stupa, with the Antikythera mechanism, with the bones from Alexander Marshak in The Roots of Civilization. So here this guy gets up. His name was Mark. I don't remember his name now. I feel ashamed. Maybe I shouldn't even talk about it. I've got notes somewhere. But he proposed that Rear Window, Lisa Fremont, Grace Kelly's character, was Aphrodite. And that James Stewart was a fallen man. And he believes that the dog, Sirius, the dog star, comes into play. And we call that the Dog Days of Summer. So the heat in Rear Window is reflective of this Dog Days of Summer, which is about Sirius. And he said he spent time looking to see if there were any stars in the film, to see if the dog shows up. And he realized that Stella, the housekeeper, has the name Stella. Anyway, that was also a fantastic paper. A really good presentation. I saw another one. I'm talking too much. Sorry.
That's okay. Go right ahead. I want to hear all about it.
Yeah, but the other one I want to mention today was on, I hope I say this right, Tomako. And that is New Zealand facial tattoos. And I thought that was super interesting. The indigenous panels are my favorite every time I try to go to them, because I find that the predictive quality of their issues really tell us what's happening in the culture. There's something going on with the panelists that present on that session. Indigenous peoples are so there really seem to be, these panels seem to be in touch with what's going on in our culture. And it's really super rewarding. So that was good. That was a, he was based in Utah, but he was from New Zealand. And he was a great speaker as well. And I will post the slides from that on our Facebook page, because I took a few pictures of his presentation. And that way I can tell you his name. And the same for the other fellow. I'll go back in my notes who did the Rear Window. So those were really two great experiences during the panels. And I went to maybe 10 panels. So,
wow, that's pretty rich. It sounds like you're having a fabulous time there. Oh, and plus, of course, you've had an opportunity to deliver your own paper.
I delivered my own paper, which I hope to share with our listeners in a week or two. We'll deal with that later. I want to, you know, be able to sit down and be calm and read it out properly. Yeah, and I had some really good feedback. So that was pretty exciting. I still want to try and go to Dublin. I don't know if I can pull that off. We'll see. The other thing Stag and I did yesterday, just of cultural events, and like I say, I think, you know, next time we talk, I'll tell you about the food, but we went to an incredible experience. Okay, one morning, we stayed in two different hotels. So the first hotel we stayed in was up the street, not downtown. And Stag was in the shower, and I was up super early. I packed up the car to move to this hotel, but I went out for coffee. And the coffee shop wasn't open yet, and I landed up talking to this fellow outside. And he told me to go to Sky City. And I take these kinds of things from strangers. I see strangers as very, portentous. And I took his enthusiasm for this city. It's a Puebla Acoma, and it's about an hour away. I said, well, listen, I'm going to do my best to get out there. So since Stag and I drove, we drove out there yesterday morning. We got up really early. And we drove out, and New Mexico is so insanely beautiful. Its motto is Land of Enchantment, and it truly is enchanted. I cannot explain. So we drive and drive, get to about an hour. And this Pueblo Acoma is, there's 300 buildings on the top of a huge rock structure out in the desert. And you come up on it, and you see several orange rock structures, and you get closer and closer, and then there's a beautiful museum. So we park, we go into the museum, and we sign up. And what happens is you get a pass, and they take you in a shuttle to the top of the structure where people have been living continuously for at least 1,000 years on top of this huge rock structure. Eugene, it's so fascinating. There's still about 15 people that live up there.
Really?
The women all own the property. It all belongs to women. Women own everything. So you get up there, and there's 300 buildings built from adobe materials. They have there's no running water. There's no heat. They definitely have wood stoves. There were some porta potties. There were what I thought looked like a shower facilities here and there. I also took a lot of photos of that, which I will post once this podcast gets published. I'll post those pictures on our Facebook page. Truly stunning. It was absolutely freezing cold. Stag developed a cold, and I still made this poor guy come out and go to the top of this mountain. It's about 400 feet up. They drive you in a shuttle. It's white knuckling. At least for Stag, he was white knuckling, and some of the highways were a bit white knuckling. Maybe not as crazy as the ones you and I have done in Montana, but getting pretty close. And we just get there, and we go into a church. You're not allowed to take any pictures of the cemetery or this church. The church was built in 1600 by the Spaniards, and it's now taken over, obviously, by the First Nations or Indigenous peoples that live there, Pueblo culture. And our tour guide took us into the church, and it was really cool. I can't explain it. It had pink and blue paint on some of the structure by the altar, and then it had red and yellow and vibrant colors and paintings hand painted on the back wall. We were not allowed to take notes, not allowed to take any photos, not allowed to take any drawings. We couldn't even draw what we saw, which was very inspiring to me. We couldn't take any pictures of the cemetery, but after that we could take all the pictures we wanted. And when we started walking around in between these structures, and there's no fence, these houses are on the top of a rock promontory, is that what you might call it?
What you're saying is you wouldn't want to have four beers and then go out to the bathroom.
No, you would not. And listen, the wind was pretty intense. You wouldn't want to go too close to the edge yesterday. It was very windy that I could feel my balance. And some of the ground, you're walking on the top of the cliffs. The ground, the sidewalks, if you will, pathways between the living structures are the hard rock. There was certainly a lot of mud and things too, little sandy pathways. So we got to walk all around it. And everywhere we went, the women had that set up tables with their pottery crafts. So that was really great. So of course we happened to sell a lot of artwork at the
good for Stag at
the conference, and we transferred it right to the crafts.
Good for you.
Yeah, good for us. One woman did have a square. She was able to on the internet, so I could use my credit card. But the rest of it, I only had cash. I used all her cash. I felt sorry. I used all your cash. And anyway, it was really fun, and I really wanted to support these women, and it felt great from one artist to another, you know? Mm-hmm. And we just had a lovely time. And oh, when we got into the church, before we went into the church, one of the women comes up, and right at the perfect time when he tells us the women own everything, she's like, she gives us all a good smile and nod. And then she comes out and sells us these incredible enchiladas and homemade bread.
Beautiful.
It was just such a wonderful experience. And, you know, of course, we're thanking everybody. Thank you for sharing your home. We realize this is your home life, and you're serving these crazy tourists, you know, and letting us see such a remarkable way of life. And it's the oldest continuously living space in North America. And they can prove, at least archaeologically and through oral tradition, at least 1,000 years. It's possible more. There was another promontory that was in the distance that they used to live on, apparently. And their story said that a terrible storm came. And they were down farming and hunting. And they had this ladder that went all a structure that climbed up to the top. But the storm was so terrible that it destroyed their way to the top of their living space. And it abandoned. They had to abandon a grandmother and grandchildren. And their spirits live up there, and they could never get back to the top of it, so they looked for another place to live. Wow. It was a beautiful day. The museum was incredible. We watched a film about their history. It reminded me a little bit of the two museums we've been to, of course, sort of had beautiful layout and storytelling, similar to the one in Pilsen, the National Museum for Mexican Culture in Pilsen. And before we went on the tour, we thought, do we have time at the cafe to eat something? Well, the chef at the cafe, he said, you really don't have time to eat my stew before the tour bus gets here. I'll wait for you. And he did wait for us, and he made us he served us a beautiful green chili stew. It was amazing.
Fantastic.
And after all that cold air, we were very grateful for it. And so was Stag. And then we drove back, and that's kind of my report for today.
Well, that sounds like you're having an awesome time. Interesting that you mentioned that they've been living there for 1,000 years, because I just came back from a city, Hanoi, which is just over 1,000 years old as well.
There you go.
Mind you, Hanoi, I think, has been, much of it has been rebuilt many times with the same bones.
Yeah. Well, you can see that these houses have had additions to them. Their living structures have all kinds of renovations. You can see that the wood stove pipes are coming out. There were a lot of windows, so glass has been brought up there. They have to bring up water. They've been bringing water to the top of that for 1,000 years.
Wow.
And that's the women's job. The women collected the water in the past.
So it's a double-edged sword. The women haul up the water, but they own the buildings.
Yeah, but the guys have to go farming and hunting. Ha ha. No, it's so beautiful. It was so wonderful and so generous of them to let tourists come up and look at their places. So yeah, we really did have a wonderful day yesterday. And that's it. You know what else is on my mind? I don't know if you have anything else you want to share right now.
I do, but go ahead.
Please go ahead then.
Well, you know, I got back on the 19th.
Yes.
And through the jet lag haze on the 20th, I read on the internet that Charles Portis passed away.
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted to acknowledge that and talk a little bit about Charles Portis and his work today.
Good. Thank you.
Charles Portis is often called one of America's greatest unknown writers. And he shouldn't really be an unknown writer, considering that one of his books, Norwood, was made into a movie with Glenn Campbell, Kim Darby, and football star Joe Namath. And another, True Grit, was turned into two films over the years. But Portis didn't have any time for the press or literary society or publicity. He liked to... He was a loner, I guess, and he liked to just live in his self-imposed obscurity. he was born in El Dorado, Arkansas in 1933. So I guess he was 86 or 87 when he passed. And I understand that he had Alzheimer's for the past 6 or 7 years. Mm. He was a Marine during the Korean War. And when he was discharged in 1955, he studied journalism and moved to New York City. And, you know, I think of him as a Southern writer, but he lived in New York City for a few years, working for the New York Herald Tribune as a journalist, and then moved to London and became the London bureau chief for the Herald Tribune. I didn't know that until I started reading a little bit about him.
I would not have guessed that.
I know, because his writing does not come across as journalistic, really.
No, but his concerns don't seem to involve, that I know of, that setting.
That's right. He gave up journalism in 1964 and he returned to Arkansas to write fiction. His first book was Norwood, came out in 1966. Mm-hmm. And it's a story of an ex-Marine in Texas, kind of like him. And it's a road trip story. And he had a preference for road trip stories that are populated by an assortment of really interesting characters. This one, Norwood, was serialized in the Saturday Evening Post, as was True Grit. It was also serialized in the Post. The first Portis book that I read was his 1979 novel. He only wrote five novels. His 1979 novel, Dog of the South. And I wonder, you mentioned The Dog Days of Summer and Sirius. Mm-hmm. I wonder if that refers in any way to that. I don't know. It's a story of Ray Midge. His wife Norma ran off with her ex-husband Dupree, with Ray's credit cards and his Ford Torino. And Ray goes after him down in Mexico. And it's a wonderful book. Wow. There's a really lovely obituary about Charles Portis in the New Yorker. It came out on February 20th. And I'd like to read just a little section of that obituary, because it's quite telling about Portis and his writing.
Okay.
It's been said that fans of Portis constitute a cult, which I think is true insofar as we generally maintain at least one core ritual. When we come across a fellow member, we recite our favorite moments from Portis until people make us stop. Here are some of mine. One, from The Dog of the South, when Ray Midge brags to the quack doctor Rio Sims that he, Midge, owns 66 lineal feet of books. Sims tells him to throw that trash out the window and read nothing but the motivational author John Selmer Dix, who is, Sims claims, the greatest writer who ever lived. They say Shakespeare was the greatest writer who ever lived. Dix puts William Shakespeare in the shithouse. Two, from Gringos. A junk trader, Jimmy Burns, has just fired a shotgun at a murderous hippie named Dan. There were two sheets of flame, and his headband and the top of his head went away. Shotgun blast or not at close range, I was still surprised at how fast and clean Dan had gone down. It was like dropping a Cape Buffalo in his tracks at one go. I wasn't used to seeing my will so little resisted, having been in sales for so long. And three, from True Grit, the book's final lines from the narrator, Mattie Ross. Time just gets away from us. This ends my true account of how I avenged Frank Ross's blood over in the Choctaw Nation when snow was on the ground. The careful wooden music of this last line, especially the omission of a "the" before snow, is what for me elevates Portis from a comic writer to a practical philosopher, at least of equal magnitude to J.S. Dix. Not the snow, just snow. The snow, the heroic iamb, is the epic material of trial and catharsis that people shouldn't hope for in real life. Snow is the unpoetical actual of what you've got and had better get used to. Don't live in too grand a key is the message of plain old snow. It is what it is. On some days, you'll avenge your father's murder. On others, you will accept a lowball offer for a load of salvaged irrigation pipe. And that really sums up Charles Portis really beautifully.
Yeah.
So rest in peace, Charles Portis. We've lost one of the great ones.
Yeah, thanks for your work. That's a good one, Charles Portis. Thank you, Eugene. It's amazing and sad.
Yes, it is.
It's a time period that he was writing those books in, when there was such a different, there was the mainstream was quite different from his books. And yet he was part of the mainstream with that movie, True Grit.
Yes, and but of course he... We know about True Grit. We know about John Wayne. We know about the directors. But, you know, no one talks about Charles Portis. So
right.
I'm very happy to be able to say, here's an author you ought to read. So well yeah. worth reading his yeah. books.
Did you read him when you were a kid or anything?
Not when I was a kid, no. I read him a number of years ago when... You know, I've listened for a long time to the music in many forms of the American South. And
yes.
You know, the American South is it has a troubled history, it has a very difficult history, but has produced some remarkable music and literature. And as I say, I'm quite familiar with the music of the South, and I play a form of music we call old time from the Southern Appalachians. And at a certain point I wanted to read some Southern authors. And so I did that. And Portis was one of the authors that came up fairly quickly when I started that mini quest to read some.
Right. Southern authors. Right.
So pretty on another cool. topic, we have a guest yes. today.
We do have a guest. I'm pretty excited. I saw her deliver a paper on a fashion panel. And the fashion panel included a university in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where our friend Steve Warbasey and his beautiful wife, Susan, the artist Susan Creamer Joy, lives. So I think that was pretty funny. I haven't texted them yet that we saw that, but they've been producing a magazine there for 5 years, and they are very socially conscious, and their mandate is social justice. At that same panel, the second speaker was Abigail Rausch, and she captured my attention so deeply. I went up to her afterwards and asked if she would talk to you and I and tell us about her paper again. So she's going to recap what she delivered. I don't know what to say that other than she's Kansas-based, she is an academic, and she's been to this conference 3 times before at least as well. And I would call her maybe a clothing activist, for lack of a better word. I can't remember if we asked how she would like to represent herself. But we recorded that at the Hyatt Regency in downtown Albuquerque, I think 2 days ago. And Eugene and I asked her a few questions, and she really helped us understand some things. And we hope you will enjoy this interview. What do you think,
Yes, Eugene? And we're going to finish off this episode with this interview. So as always, I want to thank all of our listeners for joining us. I really appreciate it. I know Candy does as well. You're sticking with us in spite of our technical issues as we as we record with music in the background and street noise and everything else. We yes. really appreciate your sticking with us. And as well, please write to us. We love it when we get emails, and you can email us at theagency.podcast@gmail.com.
All right. Thank you. And hope you enjoy this upcoming interview. And we have a guest today, Abigail Rauch. And she gave a presentation at the conference I'm at on clothing activism, I would say, for lack of a better term. I'm sure she has a better term. She gave such a stunning presentation that I really wanted her to talk to us today.
Thank you so much for having me today. I really appreciated you coming to my presentation, and I'm excited to be here.
Good. I'm very excited to see you and to be here. So I want to just start, because Eugene wasn't there at the presentation, obviously. I sent him some of the outline, but she basically talked, one of the first things she talked about that comes to my mind is about two things stood with me. One is about the kind of rampant waste that we have with buying clothing. She talked about some of the corporate stores that promote us buying things too much. And then she talked about New York Fashion Week. So there's a kind of a background, if we can go forward on that.
Yeah. My paper was called Textile Waste and Saving Face, an examination of the fashion industry's exploitation of people and the environment. I had a lot of research, and I didn't know how to narrow down my topic just because it's such a big category, and there's so many different ways and directions that you can go with it. So I mostly focused on how the consumer is being exploited, and then I also had my ending section about how the environment is being exploited. And then I also just wanted to kind of have a call to action of what do we do now that we know how consumers and the workers are being exploited and how the environment's being exploited. How can we move forward, and what can we do individually, and how can we make a difference in government to have changes actually take place?
Yes, and Eugene, one of the things that struck me was this idea that consumers are being, you know, we do know about workers and poor work environments and such, but the consumer, Abigail had some very interesting philosophy about consumption. And, you know, so if you could talk to us about that.
Yeah, so some of my research kind of varied. I read a neurological study that showed that in our brains, we have this fighting that happens when we're shopping. And it's of, we know what we want to get, but then the price determines how much conflict is happening in our brain, which leads us to either choose to not get an item, or after a lot of wrestling in your brain, you choose to get that item. And I kind of talked about how fast fashion kind of aids in helping your brain be eased in this process, which makes us actually buy things easier without feeling guilty, because the price is so low that we feel okay and justified in purchasing it. But it's really a manipulation on the corporation's part to get us to feel that way when our product isn't actually good or of good quality, and it's not actually a deal.
Right. So you're speaking to, let's say I go to the mall and I see a really new, would fast fashion also reflect fast that I'm going to buy it quickly because it's so cheap and I want to look like trendy? Would it also imply the idea of fast changes in fashion?
I would definitely say it would. And I would say the quicker that people follow trends and implement them by consuming these copied items that Zara and Forever 21 and H&M and some of these companies release, the quicker that we purchase them, we're encouraging quicker design of new items, trendier items, and an even further and faster production of them.
Wow. What do you think of that, Eugene?
Well, you know, it just sparked a very recent memory. I was just in Hanoi, Vietnam, where the number one fashion item are North Face knockoffs.
All right.
And you see particularly young men who are riding their Honda motorbikes, they're all wearing North Face knockoff jackets, like thousands and thousands of these things. I was really shocked. My first thought was, oh, the North Face company does a lot of business in Vietnam, until I realized that, well, no, that there are, who knows where these things are even being made, but they're, it's the brand people are buying, and it has nothing to do with anything to do with it, the quality or who made it or anything like that?
Yeah, I would definitely say that's how a lot of cultures are following after mostly what's being implemented in America, which is this idea that if we can't buy the designer brand, if we can't buy the luxury clothes, we'll buy what looks like it, even if we know it's going to wear out within weeks. And I thought what was really interesting is, I can't remember her name, but the woman who was moderating our panel mentioned that she went to some kind of fashion convention or forum where I believe it was the CEO of Forever 21. She had asked him a question about the lack of sustainability in Forever 21's clothing. And, you know, is that something that they're wanting to eventually change or grow in? And this CEO responded showing a lack of care in that and saying that the purpose of Forever 21 isn't to make sustainable clothing. It's to make and give the people the most fashionable on-trend items. And it doesn't really matter if it's going to last because that's not what people care about. And that's interesting because while I think that's true for some people, there's definitely a lot of people who are becoming more aware that they're buying so much more clothing than they have in the past. And because it's not lasting, they're finding themselves having to go shop so much more. So I think there is a movement that's coming of people who are becoming aware that that's not something that they really want to participate in anymore.
I think you're right about an increased awareness. I just heard the other day from our niece who has a young baby, and she's decided no new baby clothes, and she's found a place where she buys her baby clothes by the pound. And they're great. I mean, they're fantastic clothes because, I mean, the babies use them for a couple of months and they grow so fast. I mean, they're hardly worn, you know, and they can get plenty more babies using them. And they're really, really inexpensive. I forget how much it is per pound, but that's basically it. You just choose a bunch of these clothes, they weigh them up, and off you go, and you clothe your baby. Baby looks great without having to be caught in the trap of buying these brands.
I also think that, you know, some of the relationship I have with clothes is that I'm passionately, it represents something that's important to me. I had a sweater. It was a blue, I don't know what they're called. They're like a sweater on the West Coast. It was like a fake Cowichan sweater, but it was almost like a curling jacket. And it had these Canadian geese on it. I don't know if you remember that old blue jacket of mine, Eugene.
Yes, but I do.
I pretty much had it for forever. I don't know at what point I lost it. I have a couple of coats that I wear. They mean something to me. I don't care how I look in them. I mean, to other people, I care about myself. And so this idea, and I was looking at, we were at a museum, a cultural museum today for Pueblo people. And I was looking at the clothes and the honoring of these clothes in cabinets. I was thinking, how many clothes do people have? And how many do you have to have? And what's your love affair with them? Or at least your symbolic relationship with them. And so this turnover of Forever 21 based on, didn't you say something about how many seasons there were supposedly now in the, and we're talking about designer fashion.
Right. So one of the articles I was reading was talking about 50 seasons, which is pretty ridiculous about it. But that is our culture now. And I know that there's other arguments that there are actually more seasons than, and they're creating more so that there's an excuse to make different kinds of designs, which just increases sales. And for the companies.
Right. I mean, that's a season a week.
Right.
I mean, the 3 months, time is grinding by so quickly anyway. I don't know if I need it to go every week. So yeah, there's this marketing you're saying for fashion. Well, then this week, this season, you're going to be wearing this level of clothing, then that level of clothing. Where are people putting these clothes? In their house?
Yeah. I know for me, when I was younger, I was kind of awestruck by Forever 21 just because the design of the building or the rooms is supposed to be very spacious and big and feeling somewhat luxurious. And it's kind of this weird juxtaposition that the clothing in there looks nice when it's on the rack, but when you actually buy it, after like the third wash, it just looks terrible.
Totally.
And so what's interesting is I remember, you know, being someone from a lower income tier, I didn't have those fashion hauls that you see on YouTube by influencers. I didn't have the money to buy an immense amount of these clothing, but I remember feeling like I had a deal and I would get just a few clothing items and I'd have them for about 6 months, maybe a year, which is more than what you should even be wearing them for. And I remember looking at my closet and thinking, okay, I have a lot of clothes, but half of these are so unaesthetically pleasing when you look at them on the rack, and just compare that to just a few months before how they looked and how deceiving that is, that the store makes it seem beautiful and luxurious and there's nothing beautiful about it.
That's very true. You've triggered a memory in me of going to, if we had it in Canada called Le Chateau, I don't know if it's still there. And I used to love to go in there. I wore a lot of secondhand clothes. I did tell Abigail the other day, I've been wearing secondhand clothes. 90% of my wardrobe is secondhand, including my jeans and shoes and everything I have. I have a Vancouver Canucks, which was gifted to me, hockey shirt on today. But in general, almost everything except my underwear is secondhand. But Le Chateau, I go in there and I used to love it, but I remember being young and figuring out this is a total waste of my money.
Right.
I'm better off. The other thing is, it came to my mind about waste. I'll have to think about it for a second. I just lost my train of thought about Le Chateau and waste. And
The idea that clothing looks poorer after just a few washes is sort of the opposite to the traditional blue jeans, which don't look optimum until after many washes.
Oh, that is funny.
Right. And to the point where now there's companies that will, well, there was that trend for acid wash blue jeans to make them look extra worn. And I think you could even buy blue jeans now that have those rips in them. So it looks like you've worn your blue jeans to rags.
These are secondhand jeans and these are made to look like they're really old. It's quite funny that I bought secondhand jeans that were already made to look like secondhand jeans. So
that's funny.
Where do you see that after this? What do you think people can do?
So I personally have a different outlook than a lot of sustainability influencers mm-hmm. have on YouTube. And there's this big sustainability movement where people are becoming more educated and aware about materials, fabrics, working conditions, quality in general. And I think that's a really good thing. And moving forward, there are companies like PeopleTree, Pact Apparel, and a variety of others that are either fair trade or certified, sustainable, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. And so there is this uprising of ethical fashion. But something I have a problem with the idea of ethical fashion is that I don't see a lot of ethics in purchasing things regularly. So I think companies that promote in any way that you need to continue purchasing past your needs is still not ethical. So while I'm happy that some of these conditions are improving for some of the workers and the materials are also improving, I think until the climate crisis is addressed, I think it's very unnecessary and also deceitful to make us believe that we need more stuff. And that kind of goes back into this idea of materialism that I spoke mm-hmm. about in yes. at my panel, which is that we shouldn't be loving things and we shouldn't be on this constant hunt for impulse buys just to make us try to fill this void that we have inside of us. And we should be spending more of that time with people and doing living out experiences in life rather than on the search or on the hunt for a thing.
That is so beautiful. And that really struck me very, very profoundly the other day. I realized what I was going to say, Eugene. At the time I was going to the clubs, that I used to be in nightclubs and we dressed very creatively. And there was also an undergoing thing of like, of the designer clothes. And you know what was happening? People were stealing them. So at some point when you put that you need to look in fashion and you need to look different or up to date or something, what are people's choices? They may actually resort to stealing. It does feed into that mentality that you didn't have to pay for it or earn it. And then the consuming past your needs is extremely profound. And what do you attribute, are you able to attribute that to something? Would it be the consumerism in our country or spiritual vacuum? Or How would you frame that?
Frame, I just want to understand your question. So why we're on the hunt?
Yeah, you said the word void, and that struck me. Where's that void coming from?
I think it really depends on the person and their background and what you believe that void is, because I think a lot of people can agree. There's some sense of need of a fulfillment mm-hmm. in a lot of humanity, and while some attribute that to a need for a God, mm-hmm. some people attribute that to time and spent in community with mm-hmm. people, mm-hmm. which I feel like also goes hand in hand, and it can be separated or together. I personally think that it's both. Okay. I think that there's a lack of spirituality in America, and there's this culture of individualism, and that we can handle ourselves, we can pick ourselves up off our bootstraps, mm-hmm. and we can just be isolated, and we need to pursue very selfish things like our career, what's best for us, how can I get ahead? And I think this mentality is very unfulfilling, and this way of life of just focusing on ourselves and how we can better ourselves. And so I think both of it is lacking spirituality and an emphasis in our culture to seek some higher power. And then I also believe it's also lacking community and time with people, which is not only just the culture of individualism, but it's also that can be attributed to the Industrial Revolution. Yes. And, you know, now we have cars.
To mass producing clothes.
Right. Yes. And so we have these cars, and I was just actually walking to a thrift shop with my friend today. We were in Old Town Albuquerque with a group of people from our college, and I saw that there was a thrift store that was 17-minute walk. And so we decided to go on that walk to go to this thrift store. And when we were on our way there, there were just so few people out walking. And we were just kind of talking about how much more interaction with other people we would have if there weren't cars, mm-hmm. and just how the Industrial Revolution and capitalism and mass production and all of that has just changed the world that we live in.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's really what it comes down to, isn't it? That we were living within a socio-political system that's predicated on the need for constant growth, mm-hmm. right? So we're always under that pressure to consume more and more and more to drive the economy. The idea being that is when the economy grows that we're all successful and wealthy. But it's not a sustainable system, is it?
No, I really don't think it is. And I also just think the social impact of fashion and how it really separates classes of people, mm. and clothes are a way of symbolizing what class you're a part of. And I think that has been also very divisive in our society, that we can look at someone with a certain outfit and they're either intentionally or trying, or they're just a part of a class that promotes this culture of these are the clothes that we buy because that's just how we do it. And then you can look at those people and assume their class. And I think what's really amazing about this rise of vintage and thrift shopping is all social classes have the access to the same types of clothing. Mm-hmm. And there's kind of breaking that barrier and putting everyone on the same playing field of having access to fashion, which maybe could change how we view other people. Mm-hmm. Because if everyone is wearing clothes of, you know, from whatever brand, Levi's to, this is an extreme, but Moschino, you know, there are chances of people to find designer clothing at estate sales or thrift shops. If there is that break, I think there's a lot less of like a power move of, and divisiveness, I guess, yeah. amongst classes in America. Yeah.
I remember when Courtney Love went to the Oscars many, many years ago, and she was very proud of wearing secondhand clothes. Mm-hmm. And I always thought that was a very good political statement. It was like to be at the Oscars and she was in a vintage, mm-hmm. It was like a nightie from the 30s. Do you believe we should shop secondhand?
I do. As I was saying earlier, I'm not a big promoter of purchasing from ethical brands or ethical fashion as much. Mm-hmm. I think it's the best alternative to the systems we have in place right now. But I believe that people should be shopping secondhand more than anything, considering 90% of the clothes that we donate to thrift shops are actually sent to third world countries. So, you know, and the amount of thrift shops we have in every city, in most cities in America, there's plenty of clothes clothing that we need to be making use of before we start consuming ethical fashion. And we need to use what we already have. And, you know, I think it depends, you know, if you want socks, if you want new underwear, if you want new bras, shop at Pact Apparel, shop through clearance or sales. If you can't afford it, through ethical brands, but if at all possible, I would promote shopping secondhand.
Very good. Now, what about the fashion industry?
Where do you think I should go forward with?
I know that you mentioned the New York Fashion Week.
Yes.
And I was very taken with that about an idea of banishing it.
Yes. So like I said earlier, I believe the climate crisis is the biggest issue facing our world today. And a lot of politicians and a lot of people are not taking it as seriously as they need to, and not realizing what it entails about humanity and extinction. And so I think New York Fashion Week is an extreme symbol of consumption and glamour and class and waste. And, you know, just to fly out all of the models to New York Fashion Week or to London Fashion Week is just making such a big environmental impact. Just with that alone, not even taking into account the clothing or everyone else.
Or the audience.
Or the audience.
They're flying too. I mean, they're consuming that too.
Right. So I kind of am of this belief that at least temporarily we should be putting a halt on New York Fashion Week and London Fashion Week until we've addressed the climate crisis. And I think moving forward, I would like to see a lot more equality and inclusion amongst different races and genders, and also possibly even promoting through those fashion weeks secondhand clothing of different eras.
I
wonder if there's any fashion designers out there who are working with vintage and reused clothing.
There are. You're right. There are. But wouldn't it be incredible if they did these fashion shows entirely curating, go out to the secondhand stores, put the clothes together for people, and have all diverse models, diverse weight models and appearance and everything else, and show what can be done.
That would be tremendously influential, wouldn't it? Because, I mean, we know that there are some fashion designers who are enormous influencers in terms of what people are eventually buying. So if we saw people who had that level of influence working with used clothing and finding new and interesting ways of using the old, it would be, I think, very influential and fascinating.
Well, at the panel, some people were concerned that they couldn't find clothing in secondhand stores that fit them. And the thing is, there's way more variety secondhand for anything you want. And it's an adventure to go secondhand shopping. I know you're a big lover of secondhand clothes, Eugene.
Although actually I have that trouble too. I'm a pretty big guy. And if I go to a place like Courage My Love in Toronto, which is a great vintage clothing store, there'll be a small number of things that will fit me.
Yeah.
And I mean, I think another great alternative to that is, I think sometimes we think if we don't find it at the Goodwill, if we don't find it at the local charity shop, that we just need to go out and find something that fits, even if it is unethical. And I think what's really cool is the rise of apps like Mercari and Poshmark and eBay, which just enables us to look for a specific size for what we need. Yeah. And I mean, most of the people who are on those apps and who are selling these items have the measurements in the description. So you don't even have to try it on to know that it would fit you.
Right.
So, you know, if you can't find it in a store, there is a world of possibilities if you know brands you like or styles you like to be able to search and narrow your search down to what you're exactly looking for.
Yeah,
that's a great point.
It is a good point. It kind of a close. I think also what could emerge from this is people, you know, we say we want more community, is having those kind of old fashioned clothing swaps, you know, and have them itemized like that and creating a meetup that was based on that.
It's interesting that you would bring that up, because I recently started a trading group at my university, and it's not strictly for students at my university, but we meet in one of the housing areas in the lounge area. And I have people from high school that I know, and I've family members, and I've involved them in this Facebook group. And so we essentially just post items that we're going to get rid of and we're offering it to the group before. Or if we need something like, hey, I'm about to go to a conference, I need some black tights, then they can either let you borrow it or they can give it to you. And I've just found a lot more community engagement with this idea of not just relying on ourselves to just go out and buy it and take the responsibility, but sharing in community that even if it's just for a weekend, I don't need to buy a new pair of heels. Right. I can ask a friend if they have a pair of heels that I can borrow. And I love that you brought that up because I do think that encourages community and a lot more human interaction through that.
There's a company up here which was has achieved a lot of popularity up here, I mean in Canada, over the last couple of years. I think the company might be Rent Frock Repeat, something like that. They're in the designer fashion rental business. So they have an inventory of high-end fashion that they rent out for events. So if you're going to a gala or something, you can go and rent a suit or a dress or whatever, and you use it for 24 hours, and then you return it. They clean it and then re-rent it, and that outfit gets used over and over and over again on a rental basis. What do you think about that kind of model?
I think that's an amazing idea. I would definitely be curious as to how much that would cost and what classes that would apply to. Because I know with furniture renting, it's extremely expensive for people who are of the lower class or the working class. So I think that concept is really nice. I'd be interested to see what the price range would be and what classes that would appeal to. Right. But I
don't have the specific prices, but I recall when I was reading about it that it was fairly affordable compared to if you were going to go out and buy an outfit for a big event. It would be just a fraction of that cost. But, you know, I don't think it's like $5 or $10. I think it's more like $30 or $40, but I don't have the exact prices.
Yeah, I think that's a great concept. And I think that not everything applies to one class. And I think it's interesting to see just what models can apply to the most, I guess, bringing the most amount of equality to the people and at the most access to clothing. That's just my personal view.
I think that's very noble. I think it's very inspiring.
Thank you.
We both have deadlines today, Eugene, and my phone's about to go out of power.
Okay.
So
Abigail, thank you so much for joining us on the agency. We really appreciate your coming on and talking about your presentation. And it's a very timely topic right now.
Yeah, I think very compelling points. And thank you so much. It's been great to meet you and hear your perspective. It's very inspiring.
Thank you so much for having me on. And I appreciate both of you guys. So thank you.
It's okay.
It's been a pleasure.
Great. We'll see you soon, Eugene.
Okay.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
My phone's about to die. I was like,
we made it.